House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It is 3:15 on March 7th, 2016. With us, we have Representative Culver, Representative Tito, Representative Hughes, Representative Kathy Tolton, Representative Ledoux. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We only have one item on the calendar today, and that's an update from the Division of Insurance. Board Director Larry Wanghire with us today, and come on up, Larry. Tell us what we need to know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Wanghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Well, it's been some time since we spoke, and I think perhaps the market has calmed down somewhat in the fact that we were able to lift the order of impairment from MOTA, and they are now back doing business in the state of Alaska. And they are, I hope, I did not check today, but they are back on the exchange. There was a little bit of a delay with CMS getting the plans, what they call unsuppressed, and having them back on the exchange for consumers to go to the FFM or the federally facilitated marketplace and be able to access their plans. It certainly wasn't an easy time, because there's never a pleasant time to say to an insurance company or to consumers that we've had to take an insurance company and basically deny them access for whatever reason. And in this case, as you all know, it was because we were concerned about their financials. MOTA voluntarily, with the agreement of Alaska and certainly with the state of Oregon, entered into a financial agreement, a financial plan, where they are disposing of assets that they own. I can't declare them because it is confidential, but they total $180 million of assets that they own, and they are plowing them back into MOTA Health Plan, Inc., the insurance company. So it's quite a commitment to MOTA to divest themselves of these assets and to put them back into the insurance company to see that it does stay solvent and that they are able to service the needs of the consumers in Alaska and in Oregon, which are the two states that they're left operating in. As a part of this settlement, if you will, or this when we lifted our order of impairment, we also ask that they deposit $15 million in a bank account that we control. They put $5 million in February 15th. We have another $5 million coming in March 15th and another $5 million on April 15th. We think that gives us a security blanket to pay claims in the event that there were to ever be another concern with their financials. Not that we're expecting one, but we knew it's kind of a lessons learned from the first go round that because they're not domiciled here, Oregon kind of had an upper hand on us because they had the assets of MOTA, and we did not. So we did negotiate this $15 million asset, which the state basically owns. It's in a trust account, and we could access it if we needed to pay claims to consumers.
Larry, if I could stop just for a minute to do some housekeeping. We've been joined by Representative Ledoux, and I believe I missed Representative Joseph in the beginning. Both of them have been here since the start. But for some people who walked into the room, we're not hearing House Bill 248 or 304 today. We had additional information that was coming in that didn't come in until just before lunch, so the committee was not able to receive it 24 hours before this meeting. So that's it. Back to Larry.
So we are working with MOTA, and we are hopeful that they will remain in the market through 2017 and perhaps into 2018. But that is not a decision I can control. I can't force them to stay in Alaska any more than I can force them to stay in Oregon to do business in the individual or the group market. So
they're domiciled in Oregon, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So they have to stay there.
Well, but they don't have to stay in the individual market.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what they will elect to do. The market, the individual market, the results, you know, we've talked about it before. neither Primera Motor, either one, are having good results in the individual market. And I don't know that Motor will...
How many people does that currently impact?
Our enrollment numbers at the end of the open enrollment were about just over 22,000 people. Now, I expect that to probably come down a little, because when you go into the exchange and enroll, there's a difference between enroll and pay. And CMS will count it as enrollment, but then when people actually go to pay, the number will drop a little. So I imagine it'll come down maybe 21,000 in the state of Alaska, which is right where we figure we'll level off at in the individual market. I don't know that that number is going to grow much overall.
What was able to do?
So is it my understanding correct that the MOTA, which covers the dental for state employees, that's it for state employees, the dental plan?
And the 20,000 people that you're talking about, those are not state employees. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is totally correct. The MOTA dental plan, the state is actually self-insured, and MOTA only acts as an administrator of the claims. And so at any time when we were going through the issue of this order of impairment with MOTA, the state dental plan was not impacted. This 22,000 is the ACA individual market, the employer individuals that are enrolled in that market segment. And health coverage only, or under the ACA.
Is it just under the ACA, or is now all insurance under the ACA?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, they are only doing ACA plans, and their share of that 22,000 is probably a little over 50% in Alaska. And part of that is because they were competitive against Primera, which in a roundabout way may have been why we ended up where we were with the financial issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Hughes?
Hi, thank you for being here. I understand that the federal government reneged on its obligation to provide risk corridor payments and was to the tune of maybe about $150 million over 2 years to MOTA. If they had not, do you think MOTA would have been able to hold and we wouldn't be where we are?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I think they would have been in an entirely different picture. I don't think it would have saved them totally. Mm. It was over a period of 1 year. It was 2014. And what they received was basically 12.6% on the dollar of what they should have received. Now, they're still expecting to receive that money. I don't know that they will receive 15 or 16 or when they will receive that, because that was a three-year program. But for 14, they have received 12.6% of what they were expecting. And that hurt them a lot. In the lower 48, it took some of the co-ops that were established to provide insurance in certain states. It took 11 of them down. MOTA is not a co-op, but it is a regional insurer, and it hurt them. It did take a co-op in Oregon down, as far as they did have to file for, they're under the supervision of the state now and going through liquidation. But it certainly hurt them. But it was very much a contributing factor.
Are they being rehabilitated or bound down?
Mr. Chairman, MOTA or the co-op?
Oregon.
In Oregon, MOTA is operating just as they are here. The co-op, I don't know. I say that because if you were reading the trades, you'd see that they have decided to sue the government for $5 billion.
That was going to be my next question, but thank you.
And so I don't know what will come of that suit, but I think Oregon would like to see them rehabilitated. There is quite a bit on Capitol Hill in Washington right now, a discussion of what to do with these co-ops, because they were not meant to fail. And
they just failed a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and so I don't know. It's not just this one co-op. It's all of them. And so it's being very much discussed as to how can these co-ops be basically stood back up, or should they be stood back up.
So I have to ask you this. In retrospect, the fact that Alaska didn't go that direction has probably made your life a little more easier.
Mr. Chairman, it's hard to say, but we're probably lucky we're not dealing with a co-op.
Representative Hughes?
I was just going to make a comment, Mr. Chair, knowing that the federal government didn't come through with those risk corridor payments, I can't help but kind of think when it, and I know this isn't under your purview, but Medicaid and the federal government's promise, you know, if they pulled out $150 million from MOTA, they could possibly do that with Medicaid. That's of concern. I have another question because my understanding is, if it's okay, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, is that what happened is you had a lot of sick people. You had a lot of high-risk people. Is there talk right now of restructuring or making some changes to, and I can't remember what I think it's HEO or something, it's for high-risk insurance thing in Alaska, and where does that stand, and are we going to be restructuring this so this might not happen to some of those higher-risk people would be in that as opposed to bringing down a insurance arrangement?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there is a draft bill, I don't know that it has a sponsor yet, that Primera and MOTA have put forward. And it wouldn't work like a CHIA, but it would use a CHIA as basically a tool. And it would work in the way, it would work as a reinsurance. A CHIA would be its reinsurance. The insured market would be assessed very much like a CHIA worked in the old days. Everybody would contribute a little, and it would go against these high-dollar claims that are in the individual market. But rather than go directly to a CHIA as it did when it was the high-risk pool, it would be more of a reinsurance mechanism.
What's there to do?
I know we're probably getting past what the subject of this presentation is, but I'm just sort of curious. So what's the need for a CHIA now that we've got the ACA, which says that you can't, I think under ACA you can't discriminate for pre-existing conditions. So I thought the whole rationale of a CHIA was that people couldn't buy insurance if they had pre-existing conditions. So why do we even have a CHIA now?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a good question. I get asked it a lot, and there's a couple of answers. First off, when King versus Burwell was going on, and we didn't know what was going to happen, we thought we might keep a CHIA for a possible backup. That was one of our plans, was to use CHIA if we did not have we had to have a need to basically operate the individual market and the small group market. A CHIA was one of our plans. More importantly, why we use a CHIA, because it is active and it's got like 211 members in it right now. But the people that are in it, and there are a few medical, not many, but there are some that do still buy their medical, and I don't quite know why, because they don't qualify for the premium tax credits or the subsidies through a CHIA, and it's more expensive than the individual market, but they like a CHIA and they stay there, but I'm digressing. Who's in a CHIA and there's no market for is the med subs, the people that are Medicare supplements, the drug coverages. There's no market for it in Alaska. And if we closed a CHIA, I'd have nothing to offer them. And until there is a market for that, we have kept a CHIA open for the med subs.
Follow up?
I guess I'm not really sure what you mean by the med subs.
Through the chair, there's when you go on to Medicare, you get so much for your drug prescriptions, mm-hmm. and you buy a supplemental plan to supplement your pharmaceutical or your drugs. And depending on your needs, it can be very, very expensive. And in particular for high risk. Well, insurance companies do have products for that, but we don't have a one selling that in Alaska.
What about,
well,
so what about the ARP, the, what is the ARRP? Mm-hmm. Don't they sell it in Alaska?
Through the chair, they don't sell the med sup that we're talking about that a CHIA does. We've had filings made for it. We have yet to have anybody write a policy yet. So until we do, we've kept a CHIA open to service these people that are buying the med subs that they cannot get elsewhere.
Other than state employees, that must be just everybody in the state.
Yeah, through the chair, there's 211, and in the entirety of the last I looked, and I think that it was just about 50% were in the Med Sup that were on a fixed income, older or Medicare eligible, and had the high risk drugs that they needed, and they just, the only place they can get them is by qualifying through a CHIA.
Just one more question. So where does everybody else? I mean, if you're a state retiree, there's the state plan. Where does everybody else in the state who's over 65 and is on Medicare get their Med Supps?
Through the chair, I don't know that I can answer that. I can tell you where the people with the CHIA are.
Pardon me?
I can tell you where the people with the CHIA are, but where the rest of them are getting theirs, I don't know. But again, these are people that are high risk, that you know, can't get the coverage or can't find because, again, this is pre-existing, and all they're looking for are particular drugs because they need these drugs. It could be end-stage renal disease. It could be any of a host of very serious conditions. And to get these plans, they can't get them.
Can I just ask one more question? So do other people who don't have pre-existing, are they able to buy Med Supps? And assuming that they are, how come the ACA's rules about pre-existing conditions, don't they apply to medical supps?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the ACA is a little bit different. The ACA, they would have to go out and qualify or buy for the ACA. They'd have to buy the entire package. But even within the ACA, there's limits to what the plan will pay. And so these people may be at a point where what's better for them is to have their Medicare and to buy the Med Sup, rather than to have to go buy an entire individual market policy from the ACA,
okay,
and still only get three quarters of their drugs paid for and have the co-pays or have the out-of-pocket maximums, which can be quite high in the ACA individual market.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Colbert.
Yeah, thank you. Just to clarify, so a state retiree, the Med Sup would be carried by the state of Alaska if they're Medicare eligible. Is that how that works? Is there a cap on the amount that the retirement benefits pays?
Through the chair, Representative Kohler, I don't know that it's a state employee or not. These are just individuals.
Right, but in the case of a retired state employee, so Medicare would pay first, and then if it was a cost above and beyond that, a secondary insurer, the retirement benefits would pick up the tab, supposedly?
Through the chair, Representative, I don't think I can really talk to you about a state benefit plan because I'm not sure I know how it works.
Okay.
As to,
because it may, I'm just wondering if those retirees then fall into this Med Sup, a CHIA, whatever category or not. So
they possibly could. I don't know if there's any state employees or retirees in that a CHIA program.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Culver, when things hopefully slow down in a week or two, we're probably going to bring back the risk manager and the Aetna representative to...
slow down? I thought we were going to like be snowballing around here.
There'll be a brief window when things slow down, and we'll get them back in like we had at the beginning of the session. I think they have some things that they need to share as well. Please continue, Lori.
So there's also... when we unsuppressed or allowed MOTA to come back in and we reached the agreement as to what they were going to do and how they were going to bring themselves back up, and there was a little bit of a hiccup, and I think that several of you received calls from constituents because it timing is a wonderful thing, and we took them off the exchange about 4 days before open enrollment ended. And there were people that were quite upset that they only had one choice, because once MOTA came off, there was only Premera left.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that the people that had signed up but hadn't paid?
Mr. Chairman, there was that. There were people that had waited to the last minute. There were people that had signed up and then went to pay and couldn't. There were people that had signed up and then had paid their first payment but then became scared because of the press, and I'm not faulting the press, but just there was a lot of media attention on MOTA, and when we had said, you know, that we still thought, if go ahead and keep your payments, make your payments, you know, they aren't insolvent, but we were not letting them do any certain business and such.
How many people were we talking about, roughly?
Oh, at one time there was probably 3,200 at one point. So there was a lot of concern in the from individuals that people were scared. They were mad, and we did a lot of hand holding, and we people that as MOTA came back on, working with brokers, working with navigators, working with MOTA, certainly my department, if they called, we got policies backdated, we had the premiums collected, so that to the best of our knowledge, anybody that called or approached us working with MOTA, they were reinstated and had their coverage continue with MOTA. Now we know.
With all the extraordinary things that have happened in the last 6 months, how are you doing on staffing?
They're getting a little tired, but they're doing fine. Thank you for asking. I mean, we retained all our staffing through the budget and such, so we came out the same going into 17 as we are in 16.
So you can live with what you have right
mm-hmm.
now? Okay.
Yes, sir. We were fortunate when the height of MOTA that NAIC opened a call center for us. So they were able to take some of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners opened a call center for us in Oregon, both. So they took some of the overflow of calls. We put on two extra receptionists for temps so that people weren't getting a busy signal and weren't going to a machine. And so we did the best we could to that people got a human to talk to. And we did frequently ask questions. We had them translated into Spanish. We tried to, you know, keep people as up to date on what was going on as we could throughout the process, so that they're, you know, given as much comfort as we could, as we knew it, as it was developing. But we know that there are some people out there that ended up purchasing the Premier plan, and because, again, they were up against a deadline, and federal law said you have to have a policy by the end of January and enroll, and then 4 or 5 days later, we were putting MOTA back on the exchange. And they got the higher premium for a year, and it's extremely unfortunate for them, but timing was just a horrible thing. There was talk at one point, we considered a special enrollment period or another enrollment, but because we were able, we think, to reach the majority of the people, I mean, if somebody called and said, we've got a problem, we couldn't pay our bill, we couldn't get to MOTA, we were on, you know, we were 169 in line, we tried to make the payment, you know, whatever, you know, we handheld them through to make sure their coverage was backdated, a payment was collected, they were reinstated, whatever it took, so that people, we think, if they had coverage or had started the process, had the intent to buy coverage to begin with, to be covered per the federal guidelines of the end of January when open enrollment closed, they were. And so we were pretty happy with the way the end result, considering all things, with the end result of the how MOTA ended up. I'm sure that, you know, as you know, you're talking things slowing down, but I'm sure you will hear more on the ACHEA bill coming up, because I think that there, you know, I've received calls on it, from the media and such, wanting to know what's going to be done and what can be done. There's talk on the federal side of there's a fair amount of money on the federal side from the federal insurance program. It's, you know, one of those things that they didn't have enough money to pay the risk corridor, but on the reinsurance program there's billions of dollars that they didn't pay, but they can't take from one fund to pay the other. We're hoping that perhaps they will consider giving some to the state, but that's not something they're going to do today or tomorrow, but we are going to work with our congressional delegation to see if by chance they can get us some relief there. Anything we can do to get some relief to that market is necessary. It is, you know, it's a sick population. It's a small market and it's sick. We need to get the rates down. We need to get more in. If there's more people out there, we are concerned that we're missing a younger, healthier population. But at that, the way the rates are right now, they're not going to come in. They're going to pay the penalty rather than join the pool. And there's not many ways we can mandate that they come in that haven't already been put into law, such as the penalty for them to pay when they file their taxes, when they can't check the box or show the form that they've had insurance. So we are working through that or thinking of things that we can do to attract a younger population, a healthier population, to perhaps spread the risk across a little bit more. We've looked at possibly combining the individual and the small group to see if that would spread the risk out a little bit more. But then what happens is that the small group, their rates go up, and that's not necessarily going to make them happy. It might bring the individual market down, but the small group would go up. So you would hear from the employers within the small group of why did their rates go up when that's a relatively stable population right now or a stable segment of the market.
Do health insurers need a filing to add medical tourism to their policies? Or,
Mr. Chairman, no, they don't. We're seeing a fair amount of that right now, and we have talked with various people in the community, including the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association and others, and medical providers individually, about how we want to protect the medical community in Alaska and not have it become medical tourism where everybody is going outside because of the difference for procedures. It's cheaper for people to go to Seattle than it is to have the same procedure done in Anchorage. And there has to be something somewhere. We've looked at studies that have, you know, and procedures that have been, or processes that have been put into place where fee-for-services is becoming somewhat of an antiquated way to pay for medical services, and looked at Rhode Island and other states of how they're addressing the problem. I expect that we will see some changes in Alaska in the next year or so. It's going to be slow, but I do think we will see a change in the way we pay our providers.
Representative Ledoux's going to ask if she can go to Thailand, right?
No, I'm going to say that I believe in supporting local business, but on the other hand, when local business is not competitive, just seems to make sense, at least for, you know, what we can regulate. For example, on our state policies, for example, why wouldn't we let people go to California, Washington, Oregon, or even Thailand and India, if that's where they want to go, and it can be done, if it can be done for a less expensive price. I mean, that's just competition.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is competition. There's always two sides of the story. And whenever I testify or, you know, I get called by somebody in the media to talk about the cost of health care, because when you're talking health care insurance, it goes back to utilization and the cost of health care itself. And when we talk about going outside, one of the concerns is always, one, keeping our health care providers here. But the other is follow-up care. And if you receive treatment in San Francisco or Portland or whatever, doctors up here are very reluctant to see you for follow-up care. And are they doing it because they can? I don't know. But I do know that we've had several people call and say, I went outside to have a hip replacement or to have a surgery, whatever type of surgery it was, and when they came back, they couldn't have follow-up care. Mm-hmm.
Representative Duke.
So have we ever priced follow-up care? I mean, maybe it actually is cheaper to let them have that operation in Seattle, and then if they need follow-up care, if nobody will do it here, to let them fly to Seattle on a Thursday evening and do their follow-up and come back the next day.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm sure in some cases it is, but in some cases, people, depending on their age or what they had done, they can't make the multiple trips. It's just depending on the health of the person and what they're able to do.
I guess I'm not suggesting that we mandate people going out of state, but I'm saying if somebody actually wants to go out of state, and they're cognizant that they're going to have to keep going out of state for follow-up care, why wouldn't we let them go out of state?
Through the chair, I think that it gets down to what you're saying. It's the cost. If it makes more sense and is cheaper in the long run, I think you're starting to see employers do that, to allow people to go out of state and, in a lot of cases, to pay for a companion to go with them, to help them travel, because it's cheaper or less expensive than to have the procedure done in Anchorage or Fairbanks. But then there's the contingent that everyone wants to have the ability or the availability of the care in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Southeast Alaska, because we like our medical providers here. So you walk this mix of, we don't want to pay the prices they charge, but we don't want Providence to go back to a small building like it was 25 years ago either. So somewhere there's a happy medium here of how do we keep the medical community that we have developed over the years, but how do we afford the medical community that we've developed over? Because I get the calls from both sides, the insurers and the users, of how much it costs, but then I also get it from the providers of, one, how beat up they are by the insurance companies for provider agreements, but also of how, on some cases, depending on what they do, that they're barely squeaking by because of the cost of technology and what they've invested. Now, have I gone out and audited them? No, ma'am, I have not. But you hear both sides when you sit in my chair of what it costs to actually be a provider. But yet I see the spreads that we've seen in various studies conducted by the Department of Labor and others, and it's huge dollars.
I just suspect that if we started routinely to let people go wherever they wanted to go, with a companion, as long as it cost no more or less, that we would see the cost of, medical care coming down. I mean, that's the same argument that is used, for example, when Fred Meyers or a Walmart or something comes into a small community. But what about the local stores? So I was in Kodiak, for example, when we got, I think it was a Walmart. Well, guess what? All of those local businesses that said that the sky was going to fall if we allowed Walmart to come in, they're still there. Mm-hmm. But the prices have come down for everybody.
I might add, it's my understanding that if a provider or a hospital is a member of the Aetna network, any place in the country, and you get pre-authorized, you can be pre-authorized for facilities outside the state, but again, it's based on price and everything else. But if they're in the network, you get the same benefit of being using an Alaska-based network provider.
And that's true on the state's plan, I believe.
Yeah.
But we've got, part of the issue with health care is, and I don't know how we address it, but is educating people of what their plan does and doesn't do and its proper utilization. Alaska, we're not huge on primary care clinics, so people end up going to emergency for primary care because they don't know that there's another option or they can't get into another option. And so sometimes it's utilization rates that end up costing the plan so much that then drives the rate. And so sometimes it's teaching people of when they have a preferred provider, of who's in that network, and to use the network because that's what's been negotiated for them. And sometimes you get people that have been, my doctor I've been going to for 20 years, he's not in the provider network, and I don't care. I'm going to whomever. And so it just, there's all kinds of reasons why, you know, it doesn't always work for everybody. But provider networks are getting broader. Insurance companies are negotiating harder. You're seeing provider networks where you didn't see them before, such as in Southeast Alaska. So, I mean, it is, you are starting to see physicians that did not join provider networks before start to come to the table, because I think they are starting to recognize the truism aspect of medical. But it's still, we've got a ways to go to get everyone to the table to agree on what the cost of medical or what the cost of medical services are in Alaska. And there may be some things, because of the way we're situated, the geographic distances we cover, that we're never going to be able to overcome.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you. Just make a comment, Mr. Chair, if I might. My daughter's actually working emergency medicine rotation right now in Anchorage as part of her medical school training. And I just asked her, what would you estimate the number of people coming into the ER that are there, not there for emergency, but they should be going to primary care? She said she'd estimate 70%. And I mentioned to the CEO of a hospital recently the concept of setting up right next door to the emergency room counter, where you walk into the hospital, a primary care counter, and then putting up posts with ropes where people would walk down an aisle and they could either pick emergency or primary care. Because once they come to that emergency room window, they're obligated under federal law to do a whole ream of tests and all kinds of things. That's where your costs go up. So I'm just throwing that out as an idea that I think hospitals ought to be thinking about. But I have another actual question regarding, Lori, what? Help me understand what your mission is as a division of insurance. Is it to protect consumers? Does it have anything with helping assure that Alaskans have access to health insurance? Or what is your core mission?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, our mission is to protect consumers. But it takes then a lot of forks in the road, because in trying to protect consumers, then you're dealing with rates of companies to make sure the companies are solvent. And then because of the way things like the Affordable Care Act has been set up and such, you're looking at networks to make sure that the networks are broad enough so that the plans fit the networks and the network fits the plans, so that everyone's getting access that they should be eligible for to on the preferred provider agreements and such. And, you know, to make sure that people have access to the health care they need under the plans that we have the authority to regulate.
You can follow up question. So access, even though it's protecting consumer, it includes access. And I understand about last year sometime that there were several large associations in our state that received termination letters. I think the Bar Association, AFN, the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, and I believe those terminations are kicking in here in a couple weeks at the end of April. And there was some discussion that maybe it could have been prevented. You know, it's a big membership draw for them to be able to provide insurance, and now they're out on the street looking for insurance. And because part of yours is to protect consumers and make sure they have access to insurance, is there something that could have been done to have prevented that? I don't know what the numbers are as far as those particular associations I just mentioned, but considering what we're going through regarding MOTA and other things, it seems like we ought to be doing what we can to make sure that these associations could continue to offer insurance to their members.
I, to the chair, I don't disagree. We've ran up against a couple things with the associations. One, under the Affordable Care Act, if you read a strict interpretation of it, they're not allowed anymore. I think it was done with the intent to get them into the individual or the group market, the small or large group market. But what we have done in trying to work with them, because I think we resolved the issue with the attorneys and with the AFN, and we have certainly been working with the oil and gas support. What we have asked is, and it's getting back to more of a federal law, that they can give us, or their insurance company will verify to us, whoever quotes them, that they are a bona fide employer. And as long as they can prove that, then we're saying we're fine, and we'll approve the filing. But we did have significant discussions with them to work through this, to come up with, because we had conflicting federal and state regulation, and we spent a lot of time with their brokers and with the association in trying to come up with a solution to allow them to continue. And I don't know if they've been able to. I ran into their broker on the plane about probably 3 weeks ago, and I don't know if they have found a solution or not, but we have done, I think, about everything we can to help them continue that plan.
Well, I understand that actually under ACA there was ability for the state to relax. They had a ruling that would have relaxed it so that it would have maybe helped get them through this. Are you familiar with that?
Through the chair, I don't know that I'm familiar with that. I know there was a court case in Washington state. And so we looked at that, and then with advice from our counsel, we came back and said, well, our law is not quite like Washington. But again, we did look at that case. We read where that one was going. We looked at Alaska. We looked at our relationship, the impact it would have on the employers in these associations. And we came up with what we thought, okay, this would work for us. It would work for them and allow them to continue, because we truly did not want to see the associations go away. But we do feel that there was a federal regulation that under ERISA, they had to show that they were a bona fide or a bona fide employer association. And we had at one point asked them to get a ruling from the Department of Labor, which my understanding is the Department of Labor would not give it to them. So we had asked them if their insurer would just give us a letter on the deal saying that they were, we as long as our file was marked, then we were good. Because we did not want to make it onerous on them.
Thank you on that. Could you find out if there was an ability, a relaxed ruling that would have allowed to alleviate some of this problems? It may be a little late now that, as they're about to terminate here in a couple of weeks, but my understanding was that there was, and it would have allowed them to go back to their old underwriting formulas, and it might have solved this. So maybe I have bad information, but if you could check on that, I appreciate that.
I will do that through the chair.
Representative Ledoux.
So you mentioned that your core mission was to protect the consumer. So under that core mission, I guess it's not simply to protect any individual consumer in any individual case, but you're worried about the number of doctors who might stay in Alaska. Is that the impetus for your concern about medical tourism and the doctors?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't think my concern is the number of doctors that stay. I think my concern is that we don't want to be the reason that physicians leave. We want to be the reason that we, through a commissioner, a kumbaya type, that we can get them. We have started to see where other states that have had similar demographics have been able to get providers, insurers, users, and the regulators to the table and come up with a way to control the cost of insurance, benchmark inflation at a certain percent, be it the cost of, you know, the inflation in the state, what Medicaid is using, but to get to an agreement as to we cannot continue to have 40% rate increases. So there has to be a way to keep the medical community in the medical community, but to understand that it's pricing itself out, where consumers are not going to be able to afford insurance. If they can't afford insurance, they certainly can't afford to pay for the services out of pocket. So somewhere there's a role for us in there, but we're probably not the primary role, but we probably have a seat at the table.
So your role is not to make sure that we have enough doctors. Your role is to make sure that they're happy in a kumbaya situation.
Through the chair, my role is to make insurance available and hopefully affordable. But the definition of affordable is depending on, as you know, we've talked about before. You know, we have to approve rates that are adequate, and they cannot be inadequate. But depending on what somebody makes per year, if you're making, let's just say, $500,000 a year, $2,500 a month in an insurance premium may not impact you at all. If you're making $40,000 a year, a $2,500 insurance premium is a lot of money to you. So someplace, but that may be what the market needs because of claims that have been presented. And again, the cost of claims goes back to what are the physicians charging and utilization. So somehow, if we could get those physicians and all the providers or get to the reason of why is the cost of the services so high, that maybe we could get that $2,500 down, or at least to stay at 2,500, so it's not 3,600 next year and 5,400 the next year after that, then I do think the division has a role to play in that.
So are you the ones that decide whether or not an insurance company, or I guess the state of Alaska, can offer medical tourism?
Through the chair, only for the insured plans that we control, which is just about a little under 20% of the market are insured plans, would be within the plan if someone could have medical tourism. Would it be within the document that they would pay as part of their network or their preferred provider agreement or what have you, that they would fly someone out to receive the services? Such as the state of Alaska, the Department of Defense, all the federal employees, military, veterans, Medicaid, Medicare, Indian Health Service. We have nothing to say on those plans. It's just the insured percent, and it's about 20% of the state. So it's a pretty small percent. So again, I think we have a seat at the table because I think this is it's not just the insured plans that are facing the cost or dealing with the cost of medical services. It's everybody. So I think because of the 20% that we do regulate, yeah, we have a say. But I can't go in and tell Providence what to charge for an x-ray or an MRI. But I think that if we were in negotiations, all of us, to talk about what's it going to take to keep the doors of Providence open, yeah, we'd be interested in being at the table.
Representative Dean, the medical component is just a small portion of what lawyers are responsible for. It can be homeowners, personal auto, commercial coverages, mm-hmm. aviation, marine, individual life, it's a myriad of things, but it's the one that's sucking up all the oxygen in our office for the last few months. But I would guess that probably the personal lines take up a significant part of your time, and then commercial coverages as well. But this one has just come to a head since Obamacare came into effect because of all the mandates. But prior to that, I think you probably didn't spend much time on it at all.
Mr. Chairman, there's no doubt that there was a time to address how people were going to be able to access health care and pay for it. But it's a new law, and it's continually changing, and there's things that need to be changed, and people are recognizing it, and we're dealing with it as they are presented to us. And what happened with MOTA is just, and the co-ops is a typical example. The risk corridor failed, and it left us with what we... 6 months of dealing with MOTA, and you just go day by day and deal with it.
Representative Gaines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, I'm just wondering if you have the tools you need, and if I understand correctly, the insurers come before you, and they've been coming needing quite substantial rate increases. So they present, you know, what the charges are, basically. And so you're dealing with them. But can you go down the next layer to find out why the medical providers are charging so much more than Portland or San Francisco? Or are you just dealing directly and just have to take it face value? If they say it costs this much for a hip surgery in Anchorage, then, you know, then you approve it. Or can you go down that next layer, or do you need tools to do that? Would that maybe help with our health care costs across the state if you could go down that next layer?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's an interesting question, because that's what we have been working on the past few months, to see if the statutory authority is there. We have been looking at other states and what they did, and to see whether if the authority was within statute, or how they got into the providers. If they ask for the data through a filing, which if I ask an insurance company through a filing, I can ask them for a fair amount of information. And so at that point, do you ask for the providers, and not necessarily the mom and pop shops, but do you ask for that? And do I have the authority, or do I seek the authority at some point? So we have been doing our research to figure out how we do get into figuring out, so that we can have that discussion of why the costs are as much as they are.
Any further questions for Lori? You let us bring you back again maybe in a month?
Whenever you want me to come, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. And with that, we will adjourn at 10 minutes after 4.